So I'm Michael Goldenfeld, and I am from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Without introduction, I sort of feel like I'm about to go to a position before the Supreme Court. Lots of have Robert's Laws of Order pointed out to me and everything before we can even get started. So this is supposed to be a tutorial, at the same time it's supposed to be at the frontiers of the subject. So I'm going to do my best to speak at a microphone. I'll do my best to cover some elementary things, but also tell you about some exciting new things.
Can you stick this on for me, please?
All right. So, do feel free to ask questions. And it is also the case that everything I'm going to talk about, there's a fair amount of uncertainty associated with it. I'm going to talk about some developments in a pipeline turbulence that they're very promising, and other people are working on them, but my perspective is not the only perspective. And there's definitely, we're definitely not at the end of the road yet, so there's a lot to be done. And so one of the reasons I came here was to learn from other people about what we might be what direction we should go in next. So I'm going to talk about wall-bounded turbulent flows. I'm going to talk about friction. So Eberhardt mentioned in his Blackboard talk about pipe flow and about how the friction that fluids experience as they flow through a pipe is of enormous economic significance. So what I'm going to tell you is that until a couple of years ago, the only theory that we had about how to predict that friction was essentially non-existent. We didn't understand very fundamental aspects of how to compute friction in a pipe flow. So today I think we have some understanding, a bit more than we did a few years ago, but still not final. Okay, any of the original work that I'm going to talk about is work done by Nicholas Guttenberg, Tuan Tran, Carlos Amuller, my colleagues at Illinois, Gustavo Joya and Pinaki Chakraborty, and experimental work by Walter Goldberg and Hamid Kalei. So let's switch this on. All right, so this was meant to be a tutorial, so I'm going to start off with some very elementary things, and I apologize to anybody here who is an expert for which this is too simple. So everybody knows that turbulence is the last great unsolved problem of classical physics. And so the question I want to start off with was, if we solved it, how would we know whether we'd actually solved it? So there's a classical answer to this, and then there's the answer that I'm going to give. So one answer is exemplified by this famous Millennium Problem, as posed on the Clay Mathematics Institute website. And so this is a $1 million prize awarded to solving the problem of turbulence, in quotes. And here they talk about the Navier-Stokes equation, which Eberhardt talked about at lunchtime, and they talk about boats meandering across lakes and turbulent air currents. And although the equations were written down in the 19th century, it challenged substantial progress towards a mathematical theory which unlocks the secrets hidden in the Navier-Stokes equations. So that's a bit open-ended, and then if you follow through, you find that there's a precise statement for mathematicians of what theorems you need to prove in order to win $1 million. So there are things like existence and smoothness of Navier-Stokes on R3, and so on and so forth. So I'm not going to go through these things in detail. So my answer to the question is not that we need to find existence and smoothness and uniqueness and so on of Navier-Stokes in 3D. My answer is that we need to understand the connection between the macroscopic properties of the flow, meaning, say, the friction that is experienced, or the large-scale properties of average quantities as you go through space, and the microscopic velocity fluctuations that Eberhardt talked about in his Blackboard seminar, that the fluctuations, that the noisy turbulent fluctuations. We need to connect these two things. And traditionally in turbulence, that hasn't been done. If you read the turbulence literature, you'll see that there's people who study spectral properties, which are small-scale properties, and then there's engineers who study large-scale flow properties, like working up the frictional drag on shapes or in pipes, on automobiles, and so on. There should be a connection between these things. And I'm going to argue that there is a connection between them. And it's a very natural connection, because if you think of turbulence as being some kind of non-equilibrium steady state, then you might imagine that there's some sort of extension of the fluctuation dissipation theorem, which tells you, if you're out of equilibrium, how to connect the small-scale fluctuations with a large-scale drag and related by some current term that tells you how far you are out from equilibrium. So that sounds very nice, but I'm going to show you that actually one can make some sense of that and actually do calculations based on that perspective. So I'm also going to tell you about experiments, and the way we've tested our theoretical work is by doing experiments in two dimensions. So I'm going to start off with our two dimensions. So here is a picture of turbulence. This is a soap film visualized in the flow by Walter Goldberg and Shannon Wu and Martin Rutgers. And so this is I'm not going to go into how this is visualized, there are interference fringes. And what you can see, though, is a very chaotic, swirly, complex flow behavior, very different from the usual smooth streamlines that people are mostly used to.
Actually, the flow is coming from the top through there.
Yes, the flow is coming from the top. It is flowing downhill. This top here is a grid. And above the grid, the flow is laminar, and then the grid randomizes the flow, creates these vortices, and then these vortices interact in some complex way, and then further downstream, you get fully developed turbulence. And we know that we do get fully developed turbulence because we can measure spectral properties, which I'll show you later on, and we can verify that that's what's happening. So this is really a map of probably something like the vorticity in the fluid. But it's a very complex flow, and what I want you to notice is that there is structure on many, many different scales here. So that's the first thing, that there's structure on many scales. Now, the problem that we're going to be talking about is to try to work out the drag in a pipe, and I'm going to tell you about the canonical theory of this, which goes back to work that Prandtl did in the 1920s and subsequent years, which represents a sort of watershed in our understanding of turbulence. And this basic theory, as I'll explain it to you, really doesn't seem to take into account in any explicit or obvious way this multi-scale structure of turbulence. And so the question that I want to ask is, if it doesn't take it into account, then in this theory, that doesn't really represent a way to influence the friction factor and the velocity, the average velocity profile, as you move in a systematic way through this film. And so the question is, if that's not in the theory, then how could it work? Is it really a plausible statement? So we're not going to be talking about homogeneous isotropic turbulence. Eberhardt talked about some results in the Blackboard talk about homogeneous isotropic turbulence. And that's a sort of theorist's idealization. So you take your system, you make it in three dimensions, you make every correlation function isotropic, you make periodic boundary conditions, you drive it in your computer with some random noise. And I think that's completely the wrong thing to be doing in turbulence, because turbulence is fundamentally about instability. And symmetry is the enemy of instability. So if you want to understand the instabilities properly, you want to be looking at the least symmetric situations, not the most symmetric. So I would argue that when we as theorists tend to focus too much on homogeneous isotropic turbulence, we've probably missed a lot of the features of real turbulence that are worth studying. So I'm going to focus on the most simplest flow, one of the simplest flows that is not homogeneous and isotropic, and that is a pipe flow. So in this talk, we have a fluid that is flowing into a pipe like this, with some characteristic velocity v, which will end up being the integrated velocity. The pipe will have radius r, and because I'm going to be talking about real systems, we're going to also worry about the roughness of the walls of the pipe, and those are going to have a characteristic scale r. So if I want to look at the dimensionless parameters that govern this theory, there's the Reynolds number, there's the ratio of the roughness of the wall to the radius of the pipe, and then the friction factor, which is the central element of what we're going to talk about, is defined as the normalized wall stress. So you take the stress at the wall, which I'll show you how to compute in a minute, and you normalize it by rho b squared, and that gives you a dimensionless number. And that dimensionless number then will have some dependence upon Reynolds number and the roughness up to other dimensionless numbers, and the question we're going to be interested in is, what is that functional dependence? Now, this was first measured in the 1930s by Nicaradze at the Göttingen lab of Prandtl, And here is a picture of his apparatus. I'm not going to go into it in great detail for now. I want you to know that he had pipes of various diameters. He had a pipe length which was very long, and the reason it was very long was he wanted to make sure that the instabilities generated at the input of the pipe had sufficient time to grow and become fully turbulent by the time they got to the end. And the other thing that he did, which is of special interest, is he took sand grains that are wanted to disperse, he filtered them in a particular way, and then he glued them painstakingly to the sides of his pipes. And then he measured the friction factor as the pressure drop per unit length, normalized by rho u squared. So that was the classic experiment that was done by Nicaradze, which I will talk about later on, and I'll show you the data. And this experiment remains today the most systematic experiment yet done on this type of turbulence, covering a variety of scaling ranges of three orders of magnitude in Reynolds number, two orders of magnitude in roughness. Now here's the main message of my talk. So what I'm going to tell you about is that this multi-scale structure of turbulence is very reminiscent of what happens at critical points and critical phenomena at phase transitions. And I'm going to argue that pipe flow turbulence in the smooth and rough pipes behaves as if it is governed by a non-equilibrium critical point. The turbulence is some kind of non-equilibrium steady state, and there's a non-equilibrium critical point at Reynolds number equals infinity, roughness equals zero. Those are asymptotic limits that are never actually attained in practice, but the scalings that pertain to that critical point extend over the phase diagram. Pretty much in the same way that people in condensed matter physics study quantum critical points, where you have a critical point at zero temperature and some non-zero value of some coupling constant, and then that has an influence that extends up to...
What do you mean by a critical point? There's no length scale associated?
I'll explain it in my talk, but there's scaling, and also there's data collapse. So you'll see, data collapse, yes. So that's the most, the most important point about critical points is not just that you get power loss. Okay, one other question.
Yeah, to what extent does one number serve to characterize all the types of roughness that you might come across?
It doesn't. So everything I'm going to talk about is roughness where there's only that one number, there's only that one scale. But you're absolutely right. You could imagine roughness with many different scales, and I can say a bit more about that later if you wish. The next thing I want to explain is what we call the spectral connection. So usually we talk either about spectral properties, or we talk about the friction factor, or we talk about the mean velocity profile. What I mean by the mean velocity profile is that if you have a wall, you have some distance y up from the wall, you measure the average velocity at the height y as a function of y, so that's the average velocity profile, the mean velocity profile, how that varies as a function of y. So that's something that people have historically been interested in, and I'm going to show you that the friction and that mean velocity profile are connected to the spectrum, which is something that is new, and it makes experimental predictions. This theory predicts, then, how the friction factor and other properties should behave in two-dimensional turbulence, okay, where there are two types of cascade. So I'm going to tell you one of the tutorial things about this talk. I'm going to show you that there is a cascade of energy in turbulence. That's the main way that we characterize it and understand it. And in two-dimensional flows, there are two types of cascade, and that gives us a way to strongly test the predictions that we've made in the first two parts of the talk. And I'll show you that those predictions, how to make those predictions, and I'll show you the experimental data which verifies those. And then the standard textbook theory, the Prandtl theory, is not able to make these distinctions that we're able to make between flows in 3D, different types of flow in 2D, and so it's incomplete. It doesn't have a way to represent the nature of the turbulent state. Whereas what I'm going to argue is that you have to represent the nature of the turbulent state. You can't just simply ignore it, and that the way we represent it is through the spectral connection. So here's what I'm going to tell you about in this tutorial. We're going to talk about critical phenomena and the similarities with turbulence. And I'm going to tell you precisely what I mean by it being a critical point. So it's not just power law scaling, but it's data collapse. I'm going to explain why that's important to me. And then I'm going to talk about the experimental data and show you how the data behave in a way that really is consistent with the idea turbulence is a non-equilibrium critical point. And in fact, about once we get to here, I will show you how from a measurement that was made in 1933, 8 years before Kolmogorov came up with the idea of the power law scaling of the energy spectrum in turbulence, Nicolaides had essentially already measured the anomalous dimensions of the turbulent critical point. And then I'll talk about how we've tried to test the theory. And so I'm going to tell you about computer simulations and experiments in two dimensions. And then probably after the break, when we take lots of sugar and coffee and then they come back, I'll talk about what happens in three dimensions, and we can have a good and wrestling match then. So turbulence as a critical phenomenon. So here's a shameless plug for my lecture notes on turbulence, on the normalization group and phase transitions. So here's the point I want to make. Both turbulence and critical phenomena are characterized by having strong fluctuations and power law correlations. Now, the critical phenomena problem is famously solved. And the way it was solved is the following. We can work backwards in time. So Ken Wilson systematized and extended Kadanoff's theory of block spins in 1971, and received the Nobel Prize for this work that completely changed the way that we understand statistical mechanics and quantum field theory. Now, what was the problem that Wilson solved by the normalization group? Well, he explained earlier work by Leo Kadanoff, who at the time was at Illinois. Leo Kadanoff had the idea that the way we should understand statistical mechanics is by looking at how the Hamiltonian of the system, the effective Hamiltonian of the system, changes as a function of scale, the scale that we look at the system at. And he showed that if you had that idea, then you could explain some of the remarkable experimental findings that Ben Widom had reported in 1963, where he discovered data collapse in the equations of state of gases and in magnets. So that was the steps that by which the critical phenomena problem was solved, and turbulence is still unsolved. So my thinking about all this was, well, can we repeat the same pattern of discovery on turbulence as what worked in phase transitions? So that's so in this tutorial, I'll tell you a little bit about critical phenomena and then a little bit about turbulence. So let's start off with critical phenomena. So the typical problem in critical phenomena is that of a magnet in an external magnetic field H, and here's the phase diagram as a function of temperature and field. So there's a critical point, and below the critical point, the system exhibits spontaneous magnetization. So the phase diagram looks like this. If you start at low temperature below this critical point TC, and you have the magnetic field pointing down, and now you change the magnetic field to point up, you will observe a discontinuity in your magnetization, and that means that there's a first order phase transition going this way. If, on the other hand, you start at zero field and you cool down through this point here, you observe a second order or continuous transition. And I'm idealizing what actually happened in the experiment. If you measure at zero field the magnetization as a function of temperature, as you go down through here, what you see is the magnetization is zero, and then it rises from zero in a smooth, continuous way. Well, not smooth, but in a continuous way. And in fact, it's non-analytic at this point here, the critical point. So here's two stylized facts. The first stylized fact is that if you look at how this magnetization varies with temperature by that critical point, it scales as T minus TC to some power, beta. If, on the other hand, you sit at the critical point here, and now you vary the external field, and you ask, how does the magnetization change? Normally, what you expect is that if I have a magnet and I apply an external magnetic field, the magnetization that's induced is going to be proportional to the external field. That's called linear response theory. But at the critical point, the linear response theory breaks down. And it breaks down in a way that's usually characterized like this. M goes as h to the power 1 over little delta. So those are two stylized facts, and there's others. But here's the thing. Widom pointed out that these results follow from a similarity formula. And I've written it down here. I'm going to put it on the top of the next page so you can all see it. So there it is. So this says the following. Take the magnetization. It's ostensibly a function of T, the reduced temperature, T minus TC over TC, and the external magnetic field. In fact, it's not really a function of two variables. It's actually a function of one variable, which he wrote as h over t to some new exponent, capital delta. And then there's a function, of one variable, which we'll call fm, which is a scaling function. And then up front, there's a prefactor of t to the power of beta. So the claim is that that is the same thing as those two stylized facts. So I'm going to now tell you two things. I'm first of all going to show you why it is that this is the same as those two stylized facts, and then I'm going to answer the question, so what? What is the significance of this? Why is this important? So let's first of all explain why this is equivalent to those two facts. So first of all, remember that we need that m goes as t to the power beta when h is 0 for t less than tc, and so that tells you that this scaling function f must satisfy the following constraints. It must be a constant when its argument is equal to 0. Now, what happens for large values of its argument, z? So what happens to the large values of its argument occur when h is non-zero, but little t is going to 0. Then the argument is going to infinity, and now we should be able to recover the breakdown of linear response theory. But we're not going to do that unless these t's cancel out, because t is going to 0 here, t is going to 0 out in front. So what has to happen is that the t dependence has to cancel out. So let's work out what needs to happen. For that t dependence to cancel out, the scaling function must analytically go as z to the power 1 over little delta as its argument goes to infinity. And if that is the case, then as long as the capital delta is equal to little beta times little delta, then the t dependence cancels out and you recover the breakdown of linear response theory. So this formula we call data collapse. Why do you call it data collapse? It says, let me just go back, it says if I plot m divided by t to the beta against the horizontal axis, which is h over t to the delta, what I should be able to then get is a curve y equals f of x. And so that's what you do. So experimentally, you take your data taken as a function of two independent variables, you plot all those two independent variables in the way that the theory predicts, and then you look at your data, and if you're lucky, the data falls onto one universal curve. And that only happens if you've got the right exponents. So that's what I mean by data collapse.
It's sort of the same.
It's what?
It's a consequence of there being no scale.
It's a consequence, that's right. But it's going to be an important one for what we're going to do in turbulence now. All right, so these scaling variables include the critical exponents and the data have all collapsed. And what's important here is these are data, these are real data. They're taking on completely different systems, different materials, different magnets. They all follow the scaling law as long as you're in the regime of the critical point. Okay, so now let's talk about turbulence. So here's what we need to know about turbulence. So here's Leonardo's picture of...
just a quick clarification point on the previous slide. The number, network. And then following, sorry, that the data collapse. Yeah. This function that actually the critical, the RG theory can that derive this function?
Yes.
Can it calculate the function?
Yes. So that was one of the important advances that was made by Wilson Fisher, for example, using, say, the epsilon expansion to calculate that, and then you can do various other mathematical tricks to do the Bell summation and so on and so forth to calculate these things. So it can be calculated systematically.
Okay,
so turbulence. So we've seen turbulence before, but here's the thing. So Leonardo drew these sort of swirly eddy things. As Eberhard mentioned in his blackboard talk, we don't really know what we mean by an eddy. We have some sort of intuitive picture of it. But here's something that's very important, that even if we don't know what an eddy is, we at least can learn something about how they behave. So Richardson in the 1920s and Kolmogorov understood something very important about these eddies. So here's some swirly eddy thing. The swirly eddy thing breaks up into two smaller eddies. This breaks up into smaller and smaller eddies, and so on and so forth. Now, you might think that process is happening because the turbulence is running out of steam, because it's running down. But that's not the case. This process is a Hamiltonian process. It's not dissipative. That was the key insight that these guys had. So because it's a Hamiltonian process, it doesn't involve friction. And therefore, if you think about what that means mathematically, it says if I want to calculate any quantity that is in the length and time scale regime where you see this characteristic Hamiltonian process, then if you argue naively and say it should be there should be complete similarity, and therefore the viscosity should not enter into the equations. So I want to compute any quantity at all. I'm not allowed to use viscosity because the dynamics is not dissipative.
Which dynamics are you referring to as not being dissipative? 2D dynamics?
No, I'm just giving you the naive argument for why the splitting of these eddies is...
Oh, you're giving the classical Richardson argument.
Yes.
Whether it's right or wrong, you're...
Oh yes, I'm saying if you make the naive assumption about complete similarity and so on, so we can postpone. I'd be interested to hear people's views on whether it's right or wrong, and we can discuss it in detail.
It's not complete similarity; it's just independence on viscosity. It's only partial.
Well, something can be. Let's discuss it later.
Okay. Reversibility.
So the argument then says the following. If I want to compute the turbulent kinetic energy in the range k to k plus dk, then E of k is going to depend upon k. It's going to depend upon the rate at which energy is transferred between scales and ultimately becomes dissipated. And therefore, by dimensional analysis, the only choice you have is this one here. And this is the famous Kolmogorov 41 result.
That's complete similarity.
This is complete similarity. That's what I said. Yeah, that's why I said that. So this is the picture then. So this is the wave number. This is E of k. This is somewhere around here is the integral scale. Here is the scale where molecular viscosity ultimately becomes important. And then there's some intermediate asymptotic regime where you see this K41 scaling. And the measure of how turbulent your system is very simple. It's the question of how bigger scale separation there is between this scale and this scale. Once you know that's the parameter that tells you how far away you are from the critical point or how far away, how turbulent the system is. Whatever else you want to know, that practically is what we mean when we talk about how turbulent the fluid is. How big is this inertial range? That's the clean limit where one can try to make precise asymptotic statements.
Right, so the only argument I was adding to this is that you should not only look at space but also time.
Absolutely. I completely agree.
And there you have no scaling range, you say.
Well, you could say omega to the minus 5
first.
You could say omega to the minus 5 first.
You have to.
But anyway.
It's pipe flows. I mean,
let's get to things. We have a tutorial. We want to get to the frontiers of the subject. So here's the connection. So in turbulence, you have... E of k goes as k to the minus 5/3. In spin systems, if you go to a critical point, at least in mean field theory, two-point correlation function goes as k to the minus 2. And you can try to make some kind of dictionary of the correspondences between these two things, as many people have done, and as Greg Eink and I did many years ago. But anyway, there's lots of ways that one can do that. But I'm going to ask a different question here. So I've told you that in critical phenomena, you have the scaling, but the consequence of that is that you also get the data collapse law, which is a large-scale thermodynamics result. This is small-scale correlation functions. So my question is, the new question is, well, I know this is true in turbulence, so what's the analog that goes in this box here? What is the analog of the large-scale thermodynamic data collapse scaling law in turbulence? And why should I care? So let's think about that. So if we were looking at critical phenomena for magnets, we have two scaling limits. T goes to TC and H tends to zero. If we want to do the same sort of argument for a turbulent flow, then we're going to need to have experimental data on a real flow, and we're going to have systematic variation over many decades of Reynolds number, because that's going to tell you how big is the scaling range. The other thing you need is systematic variation over the other parameter, the one that corresponds to the external magnetic field. So what should that be? So here's some very simple considerations. This other parameter should somehow couple to the turbulent state. So just like an external field does for a magnet, so this other parameter should do the same thing for turbulence. And here's the idea. As Eberhardt mentioned in the Blackboard talk, pipe flow turbulence in a perfect pipe is linearly stable at all Reynolds numbers. But if I now perturb the pipe, then that doesn't work anymore. Now you start to get instabilities. Once you have instabilities, those instabilities grow, they get vectored downstream, and eventually far enough downstream, the pipe becomes fully turbulent. So what I want to claim is that the one other parameter that we can choose is the boundary roughness. And that by neglecting boundaries, we've really left out something that could be important in the problem. Let me go back and just say something about that. See if I write this. Right. So let's suppose we want to understand this critical point here in a regular magnet. Well, we know that it's silly to just look along this axis here. It's very important that we go out into the H non-zero plane in order to fully understand the analytic structure of this critical point. So if you buy this analogy, then what I'm saying is that by ignoring boundary roughness and studying turbulence, we've in some sense been trying to look at the turbulence problem not in its full phase space. It's like looking at a magnetic problem at zero external field and not looking at the full parameter space. So here's Nicolaides' experiment again, which I've already told you about, and now I want to show you what he discovered when he went and did those experiments. So what I'm plotting here is his data for the friction factor, the log of the friction factor, as a function of the log of the Reynolds number. And this is quite a complicated plot, so let me walk you through it. So the ones down here are the smoothest pipes. They have the smallest ratio of roughnesses. And the ones up here are the roughest pipes, so they have the largest values. And he varies that between 15 and 500. This regime here has a power law slope of minus 1, and this corresponds to the regular laminar flow. Why is that? Well, the friction factor is just the drag divided by the velocity squared. The velocity squared is proportional to the Reynolds number squared. The frictional drag for laminar flow goes proportional to the velocity, so therefore, in these units, the laminar drag regime would scale as 1 over Reynolds number, and that's indeed what you see. Then you see something complicated happen, something very non-monotonic. You see the transition to turbulence happening around about 1,000 to 2,000, something like this. This is something that I've been very interested in, Bjorn Hoff has been very interested in, there's a very exciting data that has been coming out over the last couple of years. So this behavior around here is an active subject of research, and I'm sure it's going to be discussed at the workshop. And then after this regime, we get this power law regime here. This power law here, this slope, goes as Reynolds number to the minus a quarter. And what you see happening is that as I make my pipes smoother and smoother, which means less and less rough, the extent of this scaling regime goes further and further and further. So if I have a pipe that I think is the smoothest pipe I have, if I can make it smoother, it's going to keep going forever, or at least as far as one can go, down this curve here. Empirically, that's what happens. And then out here, there's these bellies, this spoony shape. And then finally, the friction factor becomes independent of Reynolds number. It reaches an asymptote. And that asymptote itself, is itself roughness dependent, and it scales like roughness divided by the pipe diameter to the power of 1/3.
I guess you need to mention here that both Blasius and Strickler are empirical laws, and there are other empirical laws which fits data as well, or maybe even better. So those aren't laws of nature. Well, maybe they are, but at least they are competing.
I don't know. All I know is here is the data, and here is the minus a quarter. And here is the 1/3, and these laws, we don't know how accurate these laws are, or how seriously to take those exponents, or whether these are just good fits, because this is the only data set of any real quality. It would be very important for a real high quality experiment to be done to explore this further. However, there are other situations, like in channels, where you also see these sorts of scaling laws. Most people aren't interested in the scaling laws per se. Most people are interested in the overall shape of this curve. In fact, that was Prandtl's interest, and probably why Nicolaides did these experiments in the first place. Well, I'm interested in looking at this from the point of view of the scaling laws.
So is the one-third corresponds to the capital delta? What does one-third correspond to?
What is the explanation for the exponent?
In terms of the analogy to critical.
Well, I will show you in a few minutes how to make a kind of mean field theory calculation of those exponents. But nothing I say is going to say, oh, we're going to turn this thing into an Ising model and map the exponents. That's not going to be the argument at all. It's going to be much more detailed. So the fact that it's a third and the fact that the exponent is a third in the Ising case, that's just a coincidence. That has no significance known to me.
That's Kolmogorov's one-third, not Ising.
That's of no significance known to me. It's just a coincidence that those numbers happen to be the same.
What was capital D again?
D is the diameter. Right. I switched from using diameter and pipe radius. Sorry about that. Okay, so here are the... let's try to do the following. Let's take Nikolaj's data and let's ask the following. If turbulence is indeed governed by a non-equilibrium critical point, then how do we see that? Can we repeat Widom's analysis on these data of Nikolaj? So here's how I try to do it. I said, let's take the temperature, so t going to 0, little t going to 0 is the same thing as the Reynolds number going to infinity, so 1 over Reynolds goes to 0, and then the field control, so saying the external field goes to 0, is like taking the roughness ratio going to 0. So that's the correspondences that I'm going to argue, and so now I'm going to make my stylized facts out of Nikolaj's data. So I'm going to say, well, the friction factor is asymptotically going towards Reynolds to minus a quarter in the limit that the roughness tends to zero. And my evidence for that is that, as you saw on Nikolaj's data, the smaller and smaller you made roughness, the longer and longer the data followed this Reynolds to minus a quarter scaling. And then at large Reynolds number, the friction is independent of roughness, so for Reynolds going to infinity, this scales like this. These two stylized facts are exactly analogous to the order parameter scaling law and the breakdown of linear response theory scaling law for the magnets. And I can combine them into a unified scaling form in the following way. I can say the friction factor goes as Reynolds to the quarter times some scaling function of the roughness times the Reynolds number to some new exponent, like the capital delta we had in the magnet problem. And then I'm going to determine what this alpha is by exactly the same argument that Widom used for the critical phenomena problem. If you go ahead and do that, what you find is that alpha is 3/4, and the scaling function goes as z to the 1/3. And so then you make the prediction that the friction factor should scale as Reynolds to the minus a quarter times some single function of one variable, and that one variable is this combination. So if that's true, we can test it. Yes, sir.
May I ask, do you have an analogy to the order parameter, like the magnetization?
No.
In the turbulence?
No, I'm not making one. I'm trying to impose as minimal theoretical prejudices onto the data as possible, but as much as is necessary. So I'm not trying to say, well, I can write down an order parameter of a turbulence and so on and so forth, although of course that's a very interesting question. Okay, so here's the test. We're going to take the data, take the friction factor, a function of two variables, plotted by Reynolds the quarter, and then see if I plot against the horizontal axis being the roughness times the Reynolds 3/4, take all those pairs of data, does it work? So here's the raw data set that we digitized, and we also got from the tables in Nikolaj's report, which is available online. And we didn't correct any of the obvious typos and things like this. You take the data and plot it in a way that the theory predicts, and you get a reasonable, not perfect, but a reasonable data collapse. And that's the one that's shown here. And here I've shown you the log of it, so you can see that the data really does do a pretty good job of exploring these sort of non-overlapping regimes of the parameter space, so that we're getting a picture of what the scaling function is. Now, that's not the end of the story, because we can do better. Yes?
Was the previous graph, did it contain the laminar regime as well?
No, just
turbulence. Okay, so just, okay, starting from 2000.
Yep, just turbulence. Yes, go ahead, boys.
So the statement is that you should be comparing roughness to Kolmogorov scale rather than the crack diameter.
Yes.
Why?
Yes.
Yes. Kolmogorov scale, yes. So you can do better than this. So here's what you can do. So it's known that there is an intermittency exponent in turbulence. So if I look at how velocity fluctuations scale with scale, you don't scale as L to the 2/3, which is the same thing as the K to the minus 5/3 for the K41, but there's some small correction. It's very small, but it exists. And it's been measured, and so now you can go through the same argument that I gave you before, using the mean field theory exponent 2/3 plus this little bit, and what you end up with is a formula that looks like this. So it's a complicated formula, but when eta, the intermittent exponent, is zero, you just get back to the simple formula that I had on the previous view graph, and when eta is non-zero, then you get this. So what Merafarlane and Portalami did was they took this formula and they took Nicolaides' data and they tried to plot it in this way. And this was my original graph. And then when they now vary the anomalous exponent, the intermittent exponent eta, then they get a much better data collapse for a value of eta that is 0.02. So a very small intermittency correction, consistent with the one that's measured, makes this data collapse even better.
So the best collapse is for this value of.
This is the best collapse, and they plotted some least squares. Residual, and they plotted as a function of eta in their paper, and the maximum was at this value.
Actually,
yes.
What's the turbulence valence number of that pipe, in these pipes from Nicolaides?
They're going up to 1,000,000.
Well, that's the large scale.
Based on the large scale, yes.
But what's the turbulence? What's the Kolmogorov scale actually? Do we know?
We do know, but I forgot what it is. I'm not going to say off-hack. I don't know.
No, it went down below millimeter for sub-millimeter scale.
There's not much of Kolmogorov. I mean, the K to the minus 5.
You didn't measure spectrum.
Your spectrum would not be good.
Would not be good, of course.
But it's
not isotropic. There's no isotropic anyway. Well, the isotropic is probably.
You go to superpipe to see the spectrum.
You use the superpipe to see the spectrum, but actually they don't go much. They don't go much higher than Nicolaides did, and also in terms of isotropy, when they look in the superpipe, actually they see that it's pretty good isotropy, and also very little variation in the y direction. So it's not the case that the turbulence is strongly spatially varying. As you go across the pipe, so they've discovered that in the last Lex Smith has done these measurements in the last 2 years.
Scaling independent of the view graphs that you're proposing here, so you were doing something like the critical scaling, and you had three exponents like beta, delta, and whatever it was.
Yeah.
Could you write the equivalent formula on the board? I mean, it must be on one of your previous view graphs.
Which one do you want?
The forward
one. The previous one.
Forward. Next.
This one?
This
one?
Yeah, that.
Can I write this formula on the blackboard?
Yes. Putting it all together.
Yep.
I see. So you got a 2/3 in there.
The 2/3, yes. Remember at the moment, I'm not telling you why we use those mean field exponents,
right,
other than saying, for now, just treat them as empirical facts, just like Widom did in 1960. In a few minutes, I'm going to show you an argument where they come from. Right. You want me to write down this formula, okay?
Oh, yes.
Do you have while writing it down, do you have a question?
No, I just want, as you go through it,
You want to dwell on it.
I want to dwell on this.
All right, well. I could lend you my cell phone and I could take a picture.
Oh, that's true. That would be faster, wouldn't it?
Come on.
I'm still an old backward person. I'm only beginning to learn how to use these things.
Okay, but you really want me to write it up?
Yeah, please do.
We can take 2 plus 3 eta divided by 8 plus 3 eta.
8 plus what?
G of 3 eta. Times g of r over capital R, little r over capital R, times r, times e to the... 6 over 8 plus 3.
Yep, that's it.
Okay. All right.
That's it.
Okay, I'm going to... Okay.
Just a little remark, which is very simple. I mean, you said that this...
So, wait, 1 second. I want to make sure that the rules of the game...
No destructive, no nothing.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, so in terms of time. So we break at 3:15 and then we carry on after that.
We'll break even a little bit before.
Okay, and then we carry on after that.
That's right? Quite a small time.
Okay, well, there's a lot more I want to say. Okay, so yes, your question.
It's just a remark.
Okay, remark.
Because I wrote this review right now, and the spectrum was definitely observed in 1938 to be independent of the distance of the wall.
Yeah.
Was already observed.
In 1938.
Yes.
Right. You can go any distance you want. Well, it's not canonized as Earth, but it's universal.
That's right, and that's been confirmed in experiments that were done 2 years ago by Smits. However, that still doesn't stop referees in 2006 apparently being ignorant of that fact and. Asking questions, but it's fair enough. Okay, I'm going to take one more question and then yes.
FFM, are these M is the order parameter? Is there not F the kind of order parameter here with alternate meaning?
No. I don't want to. Let's not fixate on the order parameters and all of that.
Okay.
Okay, because I really want to just let the data speak for itself, and I'm not going to. So many theorists have fallen down the rat hole of trying to turn turbulence into a statistical field theory. That I'm doing my best to avoid doing that. All right. So here's a point that I just made, that if this analysis could have been done in 1933, if there'd been somebody who knew about these sorts of ideas of scalings, and so we really knew how to measure the anomalous.
What do you mean by anomalous critical exponents and critical phenomena?
Well, what I mean is the analog of the intermittency correction is like, say, the correction to the correlation function exponent in critical phenomena. So in
the
critical phenomena, I use the same symbol because in critical phenomena, I'd say g, the two-point correlation function goes as k to the minus 2 plus eta. Eta is again a small correction which you can calculate in 4 minus epsilon dimensions, and that's also important. Here, we also know that in turbulence there's a very small correction, that's what I mean by that.
So you're saying the numbers come out the same?
The numbers come out the same, they just happen to be small. I'm not saying that the numbers are the same, that this is in the universality class of a three-dimensionalizing model. That would be the very last thing I would say.
No, but what I was saying is that fully developed turbulence
Has
the same scaling exponent, has the same intermittency correction.
That's correct.
Eta is the same as you would do for a turbulent flow.
The eta that comes out of doing this exercise, this thermodynamic scaling exercise on Nicaragua's pipe data, where he didn't even know that the spectrum existed, let alone know how to measure it, I could already deduce that correction to the mean field exponent. Okay, so that's the summary of this part of the tutorial. Laminar flow is linearly unstable, boundary roughness is a relevant operator, couples the turbulent state, and the theory is critical. And this connection is what I'm going to call a spectral connection. And I'm calling it a spectral connection because it says that the macroscopic flow properties are directly connected to the correlations and the fluctuations at small scales, just in the same way that we are used to in critical phenomena. Okay, now I want to come to the next part. The next thing we know is we know how to predict, at least at a very crude level of argument, and certainly one that I hope we can improve, how to calculate those exponents from a theory called momentum transfer theory. So let me now tell you, since I was asked to give a tutorial, now I need to tell you a little bit about the Prandtl theory. So Prandtl's theory argued that the way you compute the friction factor was to calculate the wall stress, the velocity profile of the wall, and to do that, you need to know I'm about to do it. So what that means is you compute the stress at the wall, which is the gradient of the velocity field measured at the wall, and then that tells you what is the force that's being exerted on the wall by the turbulent flow. So that's what tau is, and that's what F is. And what Prandtl came up with was a brilliant argument that says the following: let's ask what happens if we were to try to compute the velocity as a function, the velocity profile, which means, as I said before, here is the wall, here is a distance y, here is the mean velocity, u as a function of y. So if I know that, then it turns out you can, by integrating this velocity profile, you can work out what this friction factor is, and I'm not going to go through that. Now what he did was he said, look, if I use the same sort of argument that we have before, that du by dy, the velocity gradient, must depend upon something which has, by dimensional analysis, must depend on the wall stress in these dimensionless units, tau over rho, square root, 1 over y, and then some function of the Reynolds number. And the argument is that as Reynolds number goes to infinity, as the flow becomes fully turbulent, then all of the factors that come into the Reynolds number, everything becomes independent of Reynolds number, so this limit is a smooth limit. In which case, this constant here, this becomes a constant. If this becomes a constant, I can just integrate this up, and I simply get a logarithm. So that says that the velocity profile, if I'm in the turbulent regime, so not very close to the wall, where it is very viscous, and certainly not in the middle of the wall, where there's the middle of the pipe, and then the flow is becoming symmetric on the other side, but somewhere in this intermediate regime here, the prediction is that U scales like the log of the distance, just by integrating up that equation. And then if you calculate the average velocity by knowing the velocity profile, and then from the average velocity work out what this friction is, plugging into this formula, you end up with this complicated formula here, a transcendental equation for the friction factor as a function of Reynolds number and friction factor, and you solve that, and that gives you a curve that is this straight line, this curved line that's drawn here. So the traditional view about Nicaragua's data.
I mean, very, very simple comment.
You can, let me just finish my sentence then, okay? And then you can make your simple comment. So the traditional view is that this curve is the true curve, and that the apparent power law scaling, way back over here, this apparent scaling here, and the fact that these data go down this curve and keep going down further and further as the roughness gets smaller and smaller, that just happens to be a numerical accident. But really, there is just one curve that is like this, which is a smooth curve, and it just so happens that in the range from up to about 10 to the 5 or so, it's just an accident that that function looks the same as Prandtl's function. So if you look in, say, Schlechting's book on boundary layers, that's what they'll say. And it's perfectly
not one quarter. It's not this formula,
Blasius. It's not the Blasius formula. Up to until.
That's what the.
Until the thing I'm going to tell you in the next couple of slides, there was no explanation for the Blasius scaling. It was purely an empirical thing that Blasius had found.
Blasius scaling is the laminar boundary layer, which is diffusive.
That's a different thing that Blasius did.
And Nigel, and very good experimental evidence for this logarithmic form.
Yeah.
Well, there's very good experimental evidence, but then
make discussion after the book.
Yeah. Let's discuss that. But here's the thing. When you've got, everybody knows, like, look, all the problems I ever worked on in condensed matter physics, people spent years, literally decades, arguing about power laws, because you can fit power laws in all sorts of different ways, and it's a pointless exercise. It's much better to have two variable scaling, two parameter scaling, and then you look for data collapse. Then you really understand what's happening. That's why I'm saying, let's not fixate on the power laws. Let's look at the function of two variables. Now, when you look at the Hamilton of the roughness, the Prandtl theory, or any extension of it that's ever been proposed, never was able to reproduce these bellies here. Okay? It's just simply not in the theory. It's not recognized, and for 70 years, even though people like Colebrook and White and many others had documented that these things were real, it was essentially laughed off. And what people did was, in 1944, Moody came up with a famous Moody diagram. So what it was essentially a kind of graphical tabulation of the Nicaragua data set, but kind of idealized to get away from these things here. If you have a pipe that is commercial grade roughness, which means that it's not a scientifically conducted experiment, so you have many different scales of roughness, these bellies sort of seem to be hard to detect. And so these things, these data have been tabulated, and every plumber carried them in their back pocket. But they don't agree with the scientific data. So here's what I wanted to end. Well, you know what? So you want me to stop at 3 o'clock, right? And then we go into the.
We need to go into the continue into the tutorial mode, And so maybe you'll, in 10 minutes you'll give this.
Tell me when.
Because, otherwise you will go for another hour. You know, giving it.
I'm at
3:45. We're gonna real discussion.
I'm at your disposal.
I mean, contact sport. I mean, be prepared to it. So I really want to finish it in a very smooth way now, because then, you know, like people already, I see itching, you know, to all the subject about sketch.
Well,
so,
let me.
You're already almost there. Let's have it finished in 10 minutes.
Right? Well, sure. Okay. Well, I can tell you, I can show you some of the reasons. Okay. So, what Joy and Chakraborty said was the following. They said, let's try to make a simple argument for what's happening. And their argument is simplistic, but it has definite merits, as you'll see. So their idea was that we're going to look at the momentum transfer between the flow and the wall, and we're going to explicitly ask, what does the flow look like when you have a rough wall like this? So what they said was, let's imagine I draw a line here, which is some sort of imaginary Gaussian surface or something like this, and then we're going to ask how much momentum is transported between the walls across this boundary from the edges that are trapped inside these coves here. And so the idea is that there's a characteristic scale for this line that makes sense, and this is their way of presenting it. In the discussion, we can shoot this down to pieces, because I think it's not correct as stated.
So I wanted to present
it here. So let me present the argument as it exists. And so the idea is, well, so here is the roughness scale, and then there's an additional scale, which is the scale that comes from the dissipation. These two things together filter the momentum between the contrast between the momentum in here and the momentum in here. So this scale here is something that scales with the Kolmogorov scale, and you can work out what that scale at which dissipation occurs is, and it scales as Reynolds number to the minus 3/4, and that's well known. So then the idea is this: if we want to calculate the characteristic velocity associated with eddies on a particular scale S in the flow, how do we do that? Well, remember that the energy spectrum is the derivative of the kinetic energy in that wave number range. So I can simply integrate this equation up to get that the characteristic velocity is then the square root of the integral of the energy spectrum up to the scale that you're interested in. So once you know that, then you can argue as follows. So this is their argument. They simply said, let's work out the wall stress. So the stress is a quantity that looks like this. We're going to assume that above this momentum transfer line, the fluid has just one velocity, which is the characteristic velocity of the flow, which we'll call V. So we're going to neglect the known variation in the velocity profile as you go up. We're going to neglect it knowingly. Okay? These guys aren't fools, just in the same way that Leo Kazanov knew that his scaling argument wasn't correct when he proposed it. So this is also a deliberate mistake, but it's an insightful one. So then you say, if I want to compute the stress, it has dimensions of velocity times the characteristic velocity of the eddy that's in there to compute how much momentum is transferred. This momentum contrast is going to be given as follows. Think about it this way. If I have an eddy that is very, very large scale like this, it will have not very much component in this direction, so it won't be able to transfer much momentum. If, on the other hand, the eddy is very small like this, it doesn't have very much momentum to transfer, even though it can be very efficient in the way that it transfers it. So the optimal scale that we should be concerned with is the scale that is on the scale of this momentum transfer line. So this scale S that we're going to be using then is the scale which is given by the sum of the roughness plus a contribution that comes from the Kolmogorov scale, and A is some constant of proportionality, which is order 1. So then what I have to do is I work out the friction factor from this formula. I just do the integral, so it's 1 over S, integral of E of k dk, square root. So let me, for an example, put in that the spectrum is pure Kolmogorov. We'll suppose that we are at very large Reynolds numbers, so the spectrum has essentially got a very long inertial range. If you plug this into here, you can do the integral analytically, and the answer is that the friction factor looks like this, R plus some coefficient times Reynolds to the minus 3/4, all raised to the power 1/3. That's what comes from doing this integral. And so now you can see what happens. At large Reynolds numbers, this scale, this thickness scale due to the due to the Kolmogorov scale, the dissipation, that's going to zero. So this term in here is dominated by the first term, the roughness. And therefore, the friction factor goes as roughness to the one-third, just as you see in my idealization, the Strickland law. On the other hand, when the turbulence when the Reynolds number is much lower but still turbulent, then in that case, this term dominates this. And in that case, then, the length scale is given by the Kolmogorov scale, and then the friction factor scales as this term to the one-third, which gives you one that's the minus a quarter. So the argument gives you back both of those scaling regimes. It predicts, first of all, that scaling regimes exist. And secondly, it tells you which part of the spectrum they come from, and it tells you what the exponents are. If you take this formula and plot it according to my roughness-induced critical scaling law, it satisfies it exactly. You can see that this formula here also obeys my data collapse scaling. If you then put in the rest of the spectrum, the dissipation range and the integral scale, so you can go ahead and do that. You can look in Pope's book on turbulence to get some sort of consensus parameterization of these scales. Then you get you find that the shape looks just like this. So you get the Blasius regime, you get the belly here, and then you get the flat part here. And by taking out different parts of the spectrum, by setting them equal to one, you can see which parts of the spectrum, which characteristic features of the spectrum, give rise to which characteristic features of this, of the anatomy of this curve. Okay, so let me show you. I'm going to end in 5 minutes, so I'm going to skip this, but we can come back to this at the end because I think this is a point that I'd like to get people's input on. Let me tell you how we tested this. And I'm not going to be able to go through all of this. Let me tell you how we tested it. The central prediction that we're making that's different from what everybody else has made up to now is that the friction factor is, in some sense, a transform of the energy spectrum. So that says, if I want to test this, I need to find systems with different energy spectra, and if I want to find a flow with a different energy spectrum, basically the options are that you go to two dimensions. Why two dimensions? It's known that in two dimensions there are two types of cascade, energy and entropy. And basically in the energy cascade, energy flows from small scales to large scales in two dimensions. The opposite of what happens in three dimensions. The entropy cascade, entropy is the square, the integral of the square of the vorticity, curl v squared. And this quantity called entropy cascades into the forward direction. It goes from large to small scales. And because it's in this sort of vorticity type of quantity, it has a different dimensionality. And so when you do the dimensional analysis to work out the energy spectrum in that kind of cascade, it goes as k to the minus 3 with logarithmic corrections. So these are the results that are known, and these are things that have been observed. So our theory predicts then that if you go to two-dimensional turbulence and make a two-dimensional pipe and measure the friction factor in two dimensions, you should see different exponents depending upon whether you're in one of these cascades or the other. That's the experiment that we did. So let me just summarize the difference between the classical theory and what we're saying. The classical theory assumes complete similarity. It gives you a law of the wall. Zero roughness is not recognized to be a singular point. The standard theory has no representation of the underlying nature of the turbulent flow. And therefore, it can't make a prediction for what happens in two dimensions. It doesn't see anything special about the different special spectral structure in two-dimensional turbulence. On the other hand, the momentum transfer theory says that there is a characteristic scale, that roughness, zero roughness, is a singular limit. And it represents the nature of the underlying flow in a crude way. It represents it through the form of the energy spectrum. And therefore, it makes predictions that are dimension dependent and dependent upon the nature of the turbulent cascade that has been produced. So let me skip all this. So about some jokes there. So let me just show you what the data look like. So first of all, we take these different cascades. And this, by the way, in the mud wrestling session after the coffee break, I'll be happy to go through any of this in more detail if people wish. But if you take the energy spectrum going as k to the minus alpha, you can work out what, using the the spectral connection formula, you can work out what the friction factor, how it should scale with Reynolds number. And what you predict is the following, that you should get in the entropy cascade, the Blasius regime should go as Reynolds to the minus a half, not Reynolds to the minus a quarter. Whereas in the inverse cascade, it should go as Reynolds to the minus a quarter. Now, I emphasize that the theory makes a prediction. It says there is a power law regime here, and that nature of that power law depends upon the type of turbulence you have. The standard theory doesn't say that. It says, oh, it's just some logarithm. It doesn't do anything special. But we're saying it does do something special, and we're going to predict the way that it does it. Okay, so I'm going to skip all this. This is how we did some numerical simulations to work out the predictions. I want to show you the experimental results, because they're really cool. So these are experiments that we did with Walter Goldberg and Hamid Kelly. So this is the experimental apparatus. So you take a thin film, you hold it up, you suspend the film between nylon fishing wire, you hold it up in a particular way so that it's stable, you encase this in a kind of coffin to stop air currents from ruining the experiments. Then what you do is you put little particles seeded into the flow, and you fire laser beam light at the particles, reflected off the particles. From the way it's reflected off, you can then measure the velocity components in both the horizontal and the vertical direction, and so you can measure velocity moments and correlation functions. So here's what you get when you do that. So this is the energy spectrum as a function of k in a flow that we made by putting a grid in at the top and then measuring downstream. And here you can see the k to the minus 3 regime, which is the predicted entropy cascade regime. People like Walter Goldberg, Hamid Kelly, and others have been doing these experiments now for about 15 years. This is about as good a data as it's known to get. Obviously, you don't get 10 decades of scaling, but you do the best you can. And then we measure the velocity profile as a function of different distance from the wall. We measure the slope of the origin. We then plot the slope of the origin as a function of Reynolds number. And what you get then is a plot of the friction factor as a function of Reynolds number, log, log. And these are data of many different flows, both down in Pittsburgh and in France. And these data follow a Reynolds to the minus a half law. Okay, in 3D, the Nicolaiti data follow this law, Reynolds to the minus a quarter. These data follow a power law. That's the first thing, not some weird logarithm. Second of all, that power law is exactly the one that we computed. So that's the end. So there is a Blasius regime in two dimensions. It does exist, and you can measure it. It's different from what happens in 3D. The exponent is exactly what you predict, based on this idea that there's a connection with the energy spectrum. And that's it.
Okay, thanks a lot.